Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. An airstrike overnight in central Beirut has killed 11 people and injured 63 others. The attack destroyed an eight-story building in the Basta neighbourhood. Lebanon's national news agency reported six missiles being used and what it called a large number of fatalities and injuries resulting. There was apparently no warning, and at four in the morning, most people were in bed. Ali Nasser lives in the neighbourhood. He spoke to the BBC's Hugo Pachega.
At 4 a.m., it was me and my family sleeping. It's a very horrible explosion happened. All of the windows, the glasses are over me and my wife and my children. My home now is a battlefield, if you see it. Everything is broken. My big priority, that's to take my family and get them to the street. I'm afraid that the building will fall.
How are you feeling?
Very bad. I'm upset with what's happening from Israel, from our government. And if you want one person, you fired six muscles. Is it necessary to call all these people for one person? Or we are not human? That's what I'm asking. It's very horrible. I am very, very angry, very upset. Most of them are neighbors and friends every day. You see them at morning, good morning, good morning. They die.
Well, let's hear now from the Irish Times correspondent based in Beirut, who is Sally Hayden. Sally, thank you for talking to NewsHour. I understand you live close to the area hit. Were you aware that an attack was imminent overnight?
No, I wasn't. So I live about a kilometre away, and like your previous interviewee, I was just woken up by this extremely loud series of explosions. And yeah, there was no warning. And actually, I had been staying in a friend's house until yesterday, and we had left there because that area that place received an evacuation warning. So we had come to my house because we thought it would be much safer, and then got woken up by this. And it kind of underlines this feeling that people have right now. They're like, nowhere is safe really in the city anymore.
You went to the area this morning. Describe what you saw there.
Yeah, I did. So it's an eight-story residential building that was leveled. The debris was just blocking the street. There were rescue workers there, diggers there. You know, they were lifting burned, kind of charred cars out of the space. And yeah, just seemed to be digging to see could they find anybody else.
What's happened in terms of the residents who live in those areas of central Beirut? There seem to be quite a large number of people who initially, earlier in this conflict, were moving out, were trying to get away to stay with family outside of the capital. Have a lot of people come back?
I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of people that I speak to, they've been kind of moving around. So they'll move from one location to a place they think is safer, and sometimes go back then to their homes because they decide, you know, it's just so difficult to exist elsewhere. And sometimes they do move on to other places. And, you know, even people will move temporarily and go back, or they're moving around. And some people, like, it's hard to describe, you know, there was this strike and then two streets away, shops are still open. You know, people are going on with their life because they have no other choice. So it's kind of like an ongoing terror. But at the same stage, people are still existing in this situation.
I mean, how would you describe the mood? Do you have a sense of people on edge?
Yeah, it's just been relentless. Like this last few weeks has been completely relentless. You have to pay attention all the time to whether there are evacuation warnings. Obviously, hits can come without warnings. You know, you're listening out for gunfire, which could be a sign that there's been an evacuation warning. You have to check X, Twitter, WhatsApp to see. And then when the Israeli military published the warnings, they don't have GPS coordinates. So you're then trying to figure out with their kind of slightly vague maps, like exactly where that place is and how far it is from you. And for me yesterday, I was 300 meters away, but it took us quite a while to realize that because we were trying to figure out where it was on the map. And then suddenly we realized and we were like, God, we have to run.
There have been other attacks this morning, Beirut time, in the southern suburbs, but this time with warnings.
Yeah, exactly. So some come with warnings and some without, and it depends whether they're targeting a specific individual, to my understanding. And at the same stage, of course, there's huge questions around proportionality. So when they attack without a warning, if they're going after a specific person, for example, last night, to attack a residential building at night, like, was that necessary? That's what people there say. They'll say, you know, could they not have waited till that person was in a car, for example, rather than leveling an 8-story building? And obviously, we don't still know whether the death toll is going to continue to rise on that. And but these are busy areas. It's very important to emphasize it's busy residential populated areas.
One brief last thought, if you could. There was some talk earlier this week from the US envoy to Lebanon of hopeful signs of negotiations for a ceasefire. Do people feel that that might be in prospect?
Yeah, I mean, so Amos Hochstein was here this week and people felt like the airstrikes kind of calmed down a bit. The drones disappeared a bit while he was there, but now they're obviously back with a vengeance. And I don't think people are feeling positive, but let's see. But hopeful because everybody wants peace, but let's see.
That's Sally Hayden from the Irish Times live in Beirut on BBC NewsHour. Coming up, feuding families in the Philippines. The vice president has said she has a plan to kill the president if she herself is assassinated. And in 20 minutes' time, the cello that's just been played in public for the first time in more than two centuries. We'll speak to the musician who had that honour. But first to COP29, that's the 29th meeting of the Conference of the Parties to the Paris Climate Agreement. It's still struggling to reach a conclusion about 24 hours or so after it was supposed to have finished. The meeting in Baku, Azerbaijan, is deadlocked over the money wealthy developed countries should pay to help less wealthy countries adapt to climate change. Elisa Morguera, UN Special Rapporteur on Climate Change and Human Rights, told the BBC why she believes agreement has so far proved elusive.
Climate negotiations often overrun, but I think this is a particularly remarkable delay. I think there's been an ongoing deterioration of the quality of the process over the years, and this might quite be the combination of it. We don't have the right voices in the room. We don't have the voices of scientists, the voices of people who have been negatively impacted by climate change. And on the other hand, we have an overrepresentation of corporate lobbyists.
Well, poor countries have dismissed the offer on the table of $250 billion a year. Adeo Suarez Barbarossa, Ambassador at Large for Climate Affairs of the Democratic Republic of Timor-Leste in Southeast Asia, told the BBC that a bigger pledge of money is required. And he warned that countries like his are prepared to walk away from a deal they regard as inadequate.
$250 is still far from our needs. Our red line is taking decision today. But if something's not happening because of no agreement among parties, and then we can take procedural decision and moving forward some of key elements to the next COP in Belém, Brazil, by next year. But this is the worst scenario. We want to achieve something from Baku today because climate risk is happening today. It's not for tomorrow. It's not for next year. It's too far. So the delay of the decision taking here will be a delay of addressing real loss and damage that we are facing at the moment.
Well, let's go live to Baku now. And the BBC's environment correspondent, Matt Regard, joins us. And just on that subject of how the least developed country group might react, you have some new developments that have happened just in the last few minutes, I think, Matt.
That's right, Sean. We believe and understand that the least developed country group, who represent, I suppose, the poorest group of countries here, have walked out of a meeting with the president of the COP, meeting on the finance text, which is the key and critical document here. We also understand that the Alliance of Small Island States may also have walked out of that particular meeting. Those are two critical groups in terms of getting agreement in this meeting here on a new deal on finance and on a new deal to reduce emissions of carbon. And if that is the case, it doesn't augur very well for a meeting that is now almost a day over its official closing time.
Now, this might confuse people who only, I mean, like me, hear about COPs when one happens year in, year out. And that is that the question of wealthier nations, industrialized nations, providing support to less developed nations had been agreed, hadn't it, at several COPs back. And yet the actual nailing down of the figures seems to have been elusive.
Yeah, the money in any, I suppose, relationship is always a challenge and a difficulty, and none more so than the global relationship we have with the planet and the countries that live on it, on the planet as well. It's been part of all the agreements that have been made on how we tackle this subject, that money would be addressed and that the richer countries would help the poorer countries, not just to cope with the impacts of climate change, but to transition their economies away from fossil fuels. So there's a kind of a double benefit, if you like, for the richer world. They get more mitigation, as it's called, they cut emissions quicker and they help those countries to survive and thrive as well. So that's the one of the key deals at the heart of this particular process. And it has been agreed for a number of years that the richer countries would give $100 billion to the poorer countries. That agreement essentially runs out next year and a new goal has to be agreed, which is what the parties here are discussing. And the hope from the developing countries is that they would get somewhere over $1 trillion a year from 2035. The richer countries have said that the most we can give at the moment is around $300 billion, quite a long way short of that goal. And that is proving a really difficult sticking point right now in efforts that people are shuttling around here at the moment trying to bridge.
There were reports that the European Union had kind of upped the offer a bit. But what about the United States? We've got a change of presidency imminent, a president who previously pulled the country out of the Paris Climate Agreement. If America pledges money, will it actually be delivered?
Yeah, that's a very pertinent question. The US has not been the biggest contributor on climate finance, and I think the negotiators here are aware that the United States may not be in the Paris Agreement in a few months' time. So I think they're trying to Trump-proof, if you like, any agreement that's made here. Certainly the United States is not expected to be able to live up in the short term, at least to any financial contribution it might make. But I think countries are looking at that, and they're looking at other contributors. They're looking at China, they're looking at the Gulf states, looking at those countries and saying perhaps they can step up and help out with the funding at this particular point.
Some of it topped up, though, with loans, not simply a gift of money.
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the key difficulties for developing countries is that they just don't want to take on or be saddled with more debt. An awful lot of climate finance comes in the form of loans and added to countries that are already heavily indebted. They want what they call concessional or grant-based finance, which is essentially free cash from the richer countries to them. And they want that to deal with the real impacts, such as building seawalls to protect their homes and their countries, and recovering from the impacts of those climate changes, well, adapting to the impacts of climate change. Those are areas that private finance doesn't want to invest in very much. And those are the areas they think that the richer countries should be really putting their hands in their pocket quite deeply to help them with, because they believe it's in the interest of everybody.
Matt McGrath in Baku, in Azerbaijan. Thank you for that. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up in 10 minutes, voice notes from a Ukrainian soldier on the front line of war.
Regarding motivation, yes, many people are exhausted. But there are many motivated people who are bringing our victory closer. Sorry I'm recording this voice note so quietly, it's just that we're on the Russian border.
The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom this hour. Lebanon's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike on central Beirut has killed at least 11 people. More than 60 have been injured. France says there should be no red lines in Western support for Ukraine, and its long-range missiles could be fired at targets in Russia at any time. And negotiators at the UN climate summit are still searching for a compromise on how much rich nations should pay poorer countries as reports emerge of a walkout. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Now, leaders and their deputies often fall out, but perhaps few as spectacularly as the President and Vice President of the Philippines. Security has been tightened around President Ferdinand Marcos after Sara Duterte, his deputy, said she was the subject of an assassination plot and had ordered her security team to kill Mr. Marcos if she was herself murdered. The bizarre allegation delivered by Vice President Duterte during an expletive-filled news conference after midnight follows a high-profile falling out between the two most powerful political families in the Philippines. Clive Arguelles is a political analyst and a president of the polling firm WR Numero. I asked him earlier what exactly went wrong.
the breakdown of the Marcos Duterte coalition appears to be really rooted in personal and political differences that have escalated over time. So both prominent political figures with their own significant support bases, for example, the Marcos family draws their support from the north of the Philippines, while the Dutertes are from the south of the country. And there are indications that Vice President Duterte harbor ambitions for the presidency in 2028. And this fallout is fueled by that particular political scenario, because the vice president is widely seen as a likely candidate for the presidential race. This puts her on a collision course with the Marcos camp. The important thing to note here is that Marcos' ally, particularly the Speaker of the House, Martin Romualdez, who is also the president's cousin and rumored to be his successor, have been at the forefront of high-profile investigations against the vice president for the past month. So the Congress has launched inquiries into her discretionary funds, both as Secretary of Education when she used to be part of the cabinet. And there are also similar efforts targeting her father, the former President Rodrigo Duterte, over the human rights abuses during the previous administration's implementation of the war on drugs. So these investigations, while they're really quite, you know, reasonable and valid, it really appears to be part of a broader strategy related to the upcoming elections in the Philippines. So this is an exercise of political influence where the Marcos camp can weaken Duterte's political standing as they consolidate their influence.
Now, it's a pretty unusual thing for a politician to call a news conference after midnight. Tell us about that. Tell us about the scene. Tell us what happened.
Yes. So one of the recent developments is that the chief of staff of the vice president, Sara Duterte, has been cited in contempt by the lower house and therefore was in detention. So Vice President Sara Duterte refuses to leave the company of her chief of staff. And during this midnight press conference, she has also publicly stated that she would order the assassination of President Marcos if she herself were killed, alleging that there are threats to her life coming from the Marcos camp and that she has already spoken to an assassin. So she also mentioned targeting the First Lady, Liza Araneta, and the House Speaker, Martin Romualdez. It's quite a political drama. But if you're quite familiar with the politics of the Duterte family, this is really part of their populist political brand. So they really use violent, threatening language against their political enemies.
So we shouldn't necessarily take too seriously her claim that there's a plot to assassinate her or her threat to assassinate the president.
I think that the explicit threat and the highly public nature of it marks a significant escalation, but I doubt that it's going to really translate into a well-planned political assassination. I think, as an observer, I mostly see it as an attempt to mobilize political support for the Duterte. Part of the narrative that she has been communicating to the public is that they are becoming victims of the abuse of power of the administration, that this is overreach and that this is unfair use of congressional powers. And I think it really communicates the sense of urgency and the sense of unfairness if they also resort to using the populist language of using violence and threatening language as well.
That's Clive Arguelles on the warring leadership of the Philippines. Last night, Scotland's oldest cello, having lain unplayed for 220 years, was heard in public once again in a performance in Aberdeen. The instrument, made there in the 1750s, belonged to James Beattie, Professor of Moral Philosophy at Marshall College in the city. Beattie was a distinguished public figure in his own right, once painted by the famous English artist Sir Joshua Reynolds for defeating the enemies of truth. But he was also a keen amateur musician. I've been speaking to Dr. Aaron McGregor, who lectures in music performance. He's a member of Scots Baroque, and also Lucia Capellaro, a fellow member of that group, who's a cellist and who played the Beattie instrument.
It's just stunning. It's very, very unique. It has a very kind of pure, warm and direct sound, which is very unusual. It's beautiful.
Is there any way, in its sense, in which it is different from other cellos?
Very much so. I would say that just in its design, the fact that it hasn't been touched for so long, it's in its original setup with tailpiece, fingerboard, everything, it means that the instrument feels untampered with. It's in its kind of natural state, and that means that everything about it, the way you pull the bow across the strings, everything about the touch under your fingers is completely different. So I basically just spent the last day trying to respond to it and learn it.
Dr. McGregor, tell us something about the owner of this instrument, James Beattie.
Well, he had very humble beginnings. He managed to go to Marshall College, which became the University of Aberdeen, very early as a student, as a teenager. He then later on became a professor of philosophy and became really one of the key Enlightenment figures in 18th century Scotland. So philosopher, famed poet, musician and writer on music, one of the first writers on aesthetics, and of course, a very vocal opponent of slavery, which is one of the reasons he's so well remembered today.
And that's the reason Joshua Reynolds painted him, yes?
Absolutely, yeah. It was after an essay which was kind of rebuking David Hume on his opinions on people from foreign nations, essentially.
Okay, do we know if he was any good as a musician?
He certainly was a very keen musician. He was a member
That's
of
very diplomatic answer.
He wrote a lot about music. He, in his letters, he recounts lots of musical evenings he held at his home. And he also was a very keen member of the Aberdeen Musical Society, who held weekly concerts, brought up some of the best Italian musicians and had the first orchestra in Aberdeen in the 18th century.
Lucia, let me go back to you. What was the reaction of the audience when they heard the cello?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, I wasn't really paying attention on them. I was concentrating on the cello. No, I think they loved it. And especially some of the pieces that we played by Bocchi, who was an Italian living in Scotland, I think went down very well. They really gave the cello a chance to shine, and it felt like a very fitting piece to play as well.
So, Aaron, were you there?
I think they were thrilled.
I was performing as well. I'm also a violinist in the group. So,
did you have a chance to hear what you thought of it? Just last word.
I mean, I'm blown away by the instruments. You know, the instrument was of interest to me because of its historical importance. You know, it's the oldest Scottish cello and links to James Beattie, but what you don't necessarily expect is it's going to be absolutely beautiful. The theorbo player in our group, Alex, said it's the best cello he's ever heard. Best cellist as well, of course. And it's such an open, warm, beautiful instrument. So that was a shock. A welcome shock.
Dr. Aaron McGregor and Lucia Cappellaro, both from Scots Baroque. You're listening to NewsHour. It's been a significant week in Russia's war with Ukraine. Kyiv was widely reported to have deployed US-made Attackam missiles against military targets inside Russia. Moscow, in turn, used a new projectile, it codenamed Oreshnik, with President Vladimir Putin describing it as test firing that would be repeated. With US President-elect Donald Trump due back at the White House in 2 months' time, international attention is shifting away from the battlefield and onto whether conference rooms could soon be needed. Surveys published by Gallup this week, as the conflict reached its 1,000th day, suggest 52% of Ukrainians support negotiating an end to the war as soon as possible, up from 27% just a year ago. The share of those determined to fight until victory has dropped from 63% last year to 38% this year. Here's one view from the front line. It's not possible to make a phone call from there, so this soldier sent us voice notes instead.
I've spent a few months on the front line. The situation on our part of the front is more or less stable. We're based close to the Russian border. We, the military, don't anticipate any particular change after Trump becomes president. With regards to territory, we're not sure that the war will end if we give away Crimea, Donbass, Luhansk, and other territories. We think this is more likely to be a pause and then simply a second Russia-Ukraine war. This is why we should understand that the ceasefire has to be final and conclusive, not just a pause in the war, which would give Russia time to prepare. The terms of the peace deal that we would accept is a buffer zone between Russia and Ukraine of at least 50 kilometers, plus NATO or US bases in Ukraine, as a guarantee of these countries' support for Ukraine and the provision of large amounts of weapons for Ukraine. Most of all, we need munitions for artillery, multiple launch rocket systems, grenade launchers, then short and medium range missiles. Those are the most important things. Regarding motivation, yes, many people are exhausted. There are many motivated people who are bringing our victory closer. Sorry, I'm recording this voice note so quietly, it's just that we're on the Russian border. What would be good news for us is if NATO or US armies come into Ukraine and help us fight Russia, or us reclaiming part of the territory, even if not all of it, but most of the territory that has been occupied since the start of the full-scale invasion, or at the very least, the provision of all the weapons that we need. I think with support from NATO troops, it would take us 2-3 months to end this war by counterattacking with all types of weapons.
That's a voice from the Ukrainian front line. This is NewsHour. You are listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Now to the United States. And Donald Trump announced a raft of names for his new administration on Friday. The most important was his nominee for Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, founder of the investment firm Key Square Capital Management, backed Mr. Trump last year while many on Wall Street were still hedging their bets. In fact, Mr. Bessent, who years ago backed the Democrat Al Gore for president and was formerly George Soros's chief investment officer, apparently viewed Mr. Trump's headline rise in the polls as like that of a financial investment which rises despite bad news. In June of this year, he spoke at the right-leaning think tank, the Manhattan Institute.
I think we are at a very unique moment here. Just in the U.S., I am alarmed by the size of these deficits and the spending. We do not have a tax collection problem. We have a spending problem. Number two, I think as an economic historian, you know, I think we're also at a unique moment geopolitically. And I could see in the next few years that we are going to have some kind of a grand global economic reordering. There's a very good chance that we are going to have to have that over the next 4 years. And I'd like to be a part of it.
Well, that was Scott Bessent speaking in the summer. Pete Rudiger of the Wall Street Journal covers hedge funds and investing, and he's looked into Scott Bessent's background in a little more detail. Pete, thanks for being with us on NewsHour here on the BBC World Service. Give us a little pen profile of the man, first of all, if you would.
Sure. So Scott Bessent has been a professional investor for about 40 years. Most of that time was spent working for George Soros. He really made a name for himself in the early 90s with a bet against the British pound, got Soros the nickname, the man who broke the Bank of England. That was actually Scott's original idea at the time because he was an analyst in London. About 10 years ago, he left Soros to found his own hedge fund called Key Square Capital Management. And his specialty is really macro investing. So that's looking at big geopolitical trends, betting on currencies, interest rates, stock market indices, to really see where the world economy is going and trying to get ahead of it.
Why did he become attracted to Donald Trump? Why did he see him as somebody to back when others on Wall Street, even last year, were a little bit hesitant?
You know, his politics have kind of shifted over the years. He has given money to Democratic candidates. More recently, in the past 10 years, he's kind of drifted towards Republicans. He was a supporter of the president's in 2016. He thought a lot of people were underestimating Donald Trump's chances. This time around, I think he thought Trump was the best candidate to kind of accomplish what he thought we needed to accomplish economically in terms of trade, in terms of government spending and deficits. And as you noted earlier, he saw the kind of negative headlines around Trump not affecting his candidacy, reminding him of some investments he made that were unaffected by bad news. And seeing as he thought the president would win, he wanted to support him.
The economic picture on the surface looks rosy. I think the growth rate in the 3 months to September annualized at 2.8%. But below the headlines, there clearly are areas where voters, at least, don't feel very happy. What challenges does he face?
Sure. I mean, the biggest challenge that he would cite is just government spending and deficits. The budget deficit in the U.S. is currently around 6 or 7% of GDP. He thinks it needs to be about 3% or less by the time President Trump leaves office, if we have any hope of getting our government spending under control. Tariffs and trade are another area. The president, one of his key policy areas is he wants to increase tariffs. He wants other countries to have to pay more to export goods in the United States. And that's going to drive up inflation, or has the potential to. So how do you manage accomplishing those policy goals while not angering voters any more than they already are about the price of goods and services in the U.S. is going to be a challenge.
And presumably what potentially could be unintended consequences of imposing tariffs if indeed Donald Trump does as he's threatened.
That's exactly right. What Trump wants is to bring manufacturing jobs and other jobs back to the United States. If there is retaliation from our trading partners who raise tariffs on U.S. goods, that'll obviously imperil a lot of those jobs if they are exporters here.
What about his chances of getting nominated? Are they regarded as strong? Nominated, approved, I should say. He's been nominated.
I think so. Scott Bessent is a pretty, well-known name on Wall Street. He does not have a lot of Washington experience. Though, interestingly, a family member of his was a Democratic member of Congress serving South Carolina in the 70s. But he's pretty respected on both sides of the aisle. You've seen other Trump nominees for cabinet positions like Matt Gaetz for Attorney General really kind of alarm some members of Congress. And right away, you could see that they'd have difficulty getting confirmed. That's not the case with Scott Bessent.
Pete Rudiger, thank you very much, Rudiger, for being with us from The Wall Street Journal. To Germany now, which will hold early elections in February after the collapse of the governing coalition, currently led by the centre-left Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Opinion polls suggest he's likely to lose to Friedrich Merz of the centre-right CDU. Nearly a decade after Germany welcomed hundreds of thousands of refugees from the civil war in Syria, and a few years after that, more than a million from the war in Ukraine, the BBC's Nick Robinson reports now from Berlin on attitudes that are much changed.
Standing in Berlin's central train station, where I stood 2.5 years ago, watching trains arrive, packed full of refugees, watching hundreds of ordinary Germans volunteering to hand out free train tickets to their next destination, free food and clothes, toys for the children.
This is our welcome hall. Since some people need to stay overnight, we do have some children beds over there.
Ever since Germany opened its doors to a million Ukrainians to come to this country, to enter German homes, the mood here towards migration has been shifting. And the election that's going to be held in this country in just 14 weeks' time is very likely to elect a government with a very, very different attitude.
Eingefahrene Zug auf Gleis 16, S9 nach Charlottenburg.
Go to the main stations here. You don't feel safe. During the day, from 6 in the morning to 3, 4 o'clock in the night, you see the people, African people, Syrian people, dealing, obviously. And you feel somehow police has lost control. And this is not a good development. I don't like that at all. We need to get back control.
I've come to a cafe in a prosperous district of West Berlin, Charlottenburg, to talk to Michael Wasilek. He's a businessman here, a voter for the CDU, the Christian Democrats, a man who once embraced the values, the attitudes of Chancellor Angela Merkel, but now speaks of a very different approach.
Too many of refugees is not good for a country. I don't think it's not good for the values of the country. And people feel overwhelmed by foreigners, and that feeling just can't be put aside, it's just there.
Discourses have changed and racist positions are normalized now.
Dr. Sabine Speiser, who's on the board of Berlin's Refugee Council, wishes that attitudes now were anything like they used to be just a few short years ago.
So you can easily say, okay, we have too many of them here, they better should go home. that was not possible to say like that in, let's say, like 2 or 3 years ago. Laws are already being changed. Narratives are already broadly changed. Things which have not been pronounced, certain positions, publicly, you can read them in nearly every newspaper.
It was at another train station, the station in Munich, after the start of another war, the war in Syria, when 9 years ago, Germany showed that it was determined to say welcome to refugees from around the world.
People applauding the refugees as they arrive. They're here, this is their final destination. Ordinary German men and women stood here and applauding them. Welcome to Germany. How do you feel? Thumbs up. And there's a little boy here handing out sweets to children.
The former German ambassador to the UK, Thomas Matusek, remembers how that moment made many Germans feel.
When we saw the enormous influx, it was not that the German public opinion said, oh God, what's happening here? No, they said, we are delighted. Come to us. And people were greeting them at the border. They had toys for children, etc. And to be quite frank, the Germans felt very good about it.
The mother of the nation, Mutti Merkel, as she was often called, reassured Germans that...
Wir schaffen das. Wir schaffen das, und wo uns etwas im Wege steht...
She said, wir schaffen das. We can do it. This was interpreted by people, well, the Germans can do it, everybody can come.
Hätte gern einen Kaffee, ein Croissant, bitte.
Back in the cafe, Michael once backed Merkel's approach, but now thinks it has to change.
I was very pro Angela Merkel when she invited everybody to come here. And I think we need immigration. But let's have a controlled immigration. I think that's a good thing. But people want to be here. People want to learn the language. People want to work. So help them doing this. And there sometimes we are standing ourselves in the way.
Aber auch unser Land steht in diesen Wochen und Monaten vor einer ganzen Reihe von...
The man who everyone assumes is Germany's next Chancellor is Friedrich Merz. He's from the same Christian Democrat party as Merkel, but has a very different approach to migration. He wants to close Germany's borders to refugees and talks of a threat to the country's Leitkultur. Former German ambassador to Britain, Thomas Matusek again.
What Merz, I suppose, means is... that people who come here from a different cultural background should at least try to adapt to the way we live here. That means, for instance, that you shake hands or that you let your children go to school and things, or that your wife can work and can move outside the home.
Germany's mainstream politicians are having to respond to the shift in public attitudes, to the rise of the far right, the alternative for Deutschland, the AfD. The next few weeks will demonstrate the direction in which Germany is heading. At the moment, it appears to be a much tougher attitude to migration, a much harder attitude to refugees.
That is Nick Robinson reporting from Berlin on the prospects for the forthcoming federal election in Germany. This is News Hour from the BBC World Service. I'm Sean Lay. Do stay with us. This is Sean Lay with News Hour from the BBC World Service, and let's bring you a developing story now in Azerbaijan. As we were hearing earlier from our environment correspondent, the least developed country group has walked out of its meeting with the COP29 president to discuss the new proposed money offer from rich countries that's designed to help poorer countries adapt to the impact of climate change. They think the proposed $300 billion is too low and want at least
$500 billion instead. If there is no progress, the 2 weeks of talks will collapse without a deal. Well, joining us from the capital of Azerbaijan, Baku, is Inga Fritzen-Buan. She's Senior Advisor of International Climate Policy with the environment charity WWF Norway. And in New York is Gernot Wagner. He's a climate economist at Columbia Business School. A warm welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us here on NewsHour. I want to start, if I may, with Inga, because you're in Baku. What's the latest you've heard? Is this a negotiating tactic, the walkout, or are the talks really on the point of collapse?
So this could be exactly what we need from vulnerable countries at the moment. They need to make their demands heard. What they have said is that they have not been sufficiently consulted, and so they have not been heard in their demands. And what they are saying is the offer that is on table at the moment is not, in fact, designed to help them mitigate climate change and adapt to climate change. And so they've asked for further consultations.
Gernot, from where you sit, how important is this money? Is getting an agreement to actually disperse this money, to actually provide it rather than just talk about providing it?
I think that's the key bit. So, I mean, money is crucial, to be clear. That's what climate talks are all about. It's about fossil fuels, phasing out fossil fuels, and providing climate finance. I'm less sure that it makes that much of a difference what exact dollar amount is being promised here. Especially, of course, because everything is in the delivery.
And Gernot, what's the record so far of money that's been supplied? Because this deal is to replace a previous one, which is due to expire.
It is. And so that was the vaunted $100 billion, actually dollars, euros, pounds. It was never quite sure, at least initially, which currency we are even talking about. But that started in Copenhagen in 2009. When that $100 billion was first being bandied about, and that was enshrined in Paris 2015, the Paris Agreement.
And has it been successfully spent? Has it actually appeared and has it been used?
No, is the short answer. So yes, by now we are at somewhere around $100 billion going from rich northern governments to poor nations, but long delayed. It's taken us way past 2020 to get there. And of course, by now, we know that we need much, much more money than that.
Inga, in Baku, I mean, that is presumably an important caveat in terms of, even if you can agree a figure, whether the money will be spent productively. If there is an agreement, what will it be spent on this time? Are we clear about what the priorities are for groups like the least developed countries?
So I believe for groups like the least developed countries, the low-lying island states and others, they need money for climate adaptation. They need money to adapt to the kinds of changes that we can no longer avoid from climate change.
Give me some specific examples, if you would.
Yeah. So, for example, a farmer in the global south who needs to change how they farm to adapt to a climate that is warmer or wetter or drier, and where they have to grow different crops, for example. Or a city anywhere in the world where they not only need to cut emissions by using more clean energy, but they also have to adapt public services. They have to get used to, for example, elderly people being vulnerable to heat waves. And there are many more examples such as this. And I think it's a very important point to make that agreement here and having a figure here isn't the be-all and end-all. The be-all and end-all is to get that money out to the vulnerable communities all over the world.
How frustrated are less developed countries about how this process has been handled, not just at this COP, but over the whole series of meetings?
I think that they are very frustrated. So I have been following this process since 2007. And back then, I remember feeling that we were kind of at the beginning of things, beginning of fixing the climate crisis. It's now been nearly two decades and very little has been done. And the vulnerable countries, the least developed countries and the island states are feeling this every day. Right. They have water up to their ankles at this point. And then seeing that rich countries are failing to take the lead once again is very frustrating.
Gernot Wagner in New York. This isn't the only money that's going into what one could call climate expenditure, is it? Because there's quite a big investment is in renewable energy, in the use of non-fossil fuel energy sources. Is that in the end more significant, do you think?
It is different, right? So Inga is absolutely right that we need these, you know, $100+ billion for adaptation alone, for making sure we are able to adapt to what is in store. And there's plenty of climate change already baked in and happening as we speak. The renewable energy deployment, the trillions of dollars, quite literally, also here in the US through President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, for example, going into cutting emissions in the first place is also much needed and is in fact happening, will happen despite Trump being elected, for example. But it is very different from adapting to what is in store, where, yes, it does take public funding for the most part to be able to help those who are most vulnerable to what's in store.
And Inga Fritzenbuan in Baku there for WWF Norway, the environment charity. What happens if this negotiation does collapse? What comes next?
It's hard to say, and I think it is still too early to say that it would collapse. It is Saturday evening, Baku time now. It is not unusual for these summits to last until Sunday. Some people are saying that a no-deal result is better than a bad-deal result. But I'm hoping that everything can be resolved tomorrow with good and good climate ambition that serves everybody in the global community.
Gernot Wagner, your thoughts on that?
Well, here is hoping. Frankly, in many ways, we've been talking about $100+ billion now for a decade plus, and we are behind. We are very much behind. You know, whether it's a day late or not, in many ways, doesn't matter. Good. Of course, the proof is in the delivery of those funds, and that won't happen tomorrow. That will hopefully play out with national governments putting up the money, delivering over the coming months and years.
Gernot Wagner, climate economist at Columbia Business School, and Inga Fritzenbuan from the environment charity WWF Norway. Thank you very much for talking to NewsHour.